This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Today we're interviewing Shane Doyle. Dr. Shane Doyle is a Montana-based scholar, teacher, and community advocate whose work focuses on the history and heritage of Native American tribes of the Northern Great Plains. Shane is an enrolled member of the Absaloqui Nation, also known as the Crow Tribe, and he holds a doctorate in curriculum and instruction from Montana State University. Shane grew up in Crow Agency, and he's built his career around making American Native American history a cultural mainstay in everything from Montana's educational system to government land management decisions. Whether designing educational curriculums, making films, or singing Northern Plains tribal music, Shane is always focused on serving his community. So welcome, Shane. It's great to be talking with you today.
Wow, thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. It's great to be here with you, John.
Okay, good. Well, let me just say, the number of Native Americans that occupied some places and roamed across North America when Columbus arrived in 1492 is estimated to have been between 10 and 100 million, with 7 to 10 million living north of the Rio Grande. Indians have developed rather impressive cultural centers in various places, most notably in the Mississippi River Valley. When white Europeans came in, they introduced several deadly contagious diseases spread across the continent and destroyed whole communities that weren't able to defend themselves with immunity. Violent conflicts ensued, causing further loss, so that tribal members in both Canada and the United States by the 19th century signed multiple treaties that confined these people to reservation lands and limited their rights. These treaties are the foundation of the legal relationship that prevails today in the U.S. The word sovereignty is used today to identify that relationship. So I'd like to begin our discussion there, but first I think we better just talk about the Native American view regarding wildlife and the election that just happened. So I'm just interviewing you a week later now, and I want to get oriented. So, Shana, I know of at least one tribe further north in Montana that voted strongly for Democrat Kamala Harris for president and Tester for U.S. Senator from Montana. Both Democrats lost. So do you know of any diversity of support among other tribal groups here in Montana?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I think by and large, tribal communities tend to vote Democrat. You know, they are, you know, lean towards Democratic candidates. In the past, they have. I think this year was a bit different. We saw, you know, Republican candidates win in at least four of the counties that reservations are located within in eastern Montana. And I think that was a bit of a surprise.
Mm. So there was some diversity of support among different tribal groups?
I think there was some diversity of support, although I would say if you actually, you know, just did a poll in most tribal communities that, you know, they would lean towards the Democratic side of things.
What were the important issues for the tribes in both the presidential and then the Senate campaigns?
Well, it's a good question. I think, well, first of all, let me preface by saying that by and large, predominantly, the biggest concerns in Indian country are have to do with local politics. And so, you know, the local tribal council, the tribal chairman, those offices and the services and the duties that they provide and take care of every day, I think are much higher on the priority list than national politics. But that being said, I think that you know, those of us in Indian country who have an eye on national politics are looking for continued support of Native participation at the higher levels of government. And so I think a couple of examples, of course, are the Interior Secretary that was appointed by the Biden administration, and then also the Director of the National Park Service, Chuck Sams.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's highly unlikely that the new administration is going to appoint another Native American to head the Interior Department.
Yeah, I think that's a good bet.
Mm-hmm. And also, you know, with an eye on preserving Native sacred sites and being able to protect areas that have yet to be established as sacred sites, I think it's going to be an uphill climb with this new administration to recognize new areas of you know, sacredness to Native people.
Mm-hmm. So those, I guess, would be a very important concern. Are there any other concerns or measures
I think
the administration that will affect tribal groups?
Another thing I really emphasize is that tribes here in Montana had a long-standing and pretty good relationship with Senator John Tester.
Uh-huh.
He was a strong tribal advocate on behalf of tribes for health care and you know, a variety of other topics. And he had been, you know, a visible presence in tribal communities for a dozen years now. And the fact now that he's going to be replaced by someone who doesn't have any real experience in Indian country and mm-hmm. has not necessarily positioned himself to ingratiate himself with Native people by some of his previous comments made during the campaign. I think all those things were concerns in Indian country.
Yeah, well, not only that, but the area, I looked at a map, and the counties where it showed red or where it showed blue were the counties where there are large Indian reservations. And I'm just concerned about what acts the administration might take that would be deleterious to tribal groups.
Well, that's a great point. I think at this stage of the game, anything's on the table. You know, I mean, the Trump administration could legitimately ask for the liquidation, the elimination of all Native tribes.
Mm.
You know, I think that that's something that's not beyond his reach or beyond his realm. And I think, you know, now that he kind of controls the Congress and the Senate and, of course, the courts, the Supreme Courts and a lot of the, you know, district courts,
mm-hmm.
I don't know that there would be anything that we could do about it to stop it.
Wow. So does the status of sovereignty, is that a defense against adverse actions that might be taken? What's the concept of sovereignty?
I think, honestly, John, sovereignty has created more of a backlash than it has really helped tribes.
Really?
You know, the term itself, I think the term itself is confusing. No one really fully understands what it means in the context of Native people. It gets tossed around a lot, you know, by lawyers and by tribal politicians, and, you know, we're expected to understand what they mean, but I don't think that that's an issue in Indian country. I think what the bigger issue is nation building. You know, how can we build our communities up? How can we strengthen our economies? How can we, you know, create resources within our local communities that young people and even older folks can can enjoy and have a higher quality of life, talking about food systems and recreation centers and, you know, higher quality of education. You know, there's a number of ways that we can improve quality of life in tribal communities. And I think that that's the bigger issue. And sometimes we like to talk about tribal sovereignty. And, you know, the fact of the matter is tribes are not sovereign. You know, we vote in national elections. We do not have our own standing armies. You know, we enlist in the United States military just like every other U.S. citizen. You know, we are partially sovereign because, of course, we have treaties to lean on. But more than that, we have local control. And I think that that's something that you see across the United States, not just in Indian country. I mean, you go to any local rural area and those folks there, they want to control what happens in that zone. And it doesn't matter what color their skin is or what their heritage is. And so people like to get tripped up. They like to get, you know, really fired up about tribal sovereignty and Indians this and Indians that. But really, it's more just the American way of life.
Well, a treaty is an agreement between sovereign nations or countries, and there are treaties. So if sovereignty doesn't mean anything, do the treaties mean anything?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the treaties absolutely still mean something, and the sovereignty does still mean something to a certain, not completely, you know, throwing the baby out with the bathwater. But I think that, you know, we don't want to put all the focus on, you know, that term and that concept of sovereignty. That's not a native term. You know, I mean, that comes from, I think, French. I think it's a French term. I'm not sure, but I think the treaties of absolutely do have meaning still because, you know, they were signed by the United States government. They were passed by Congress. They were signed by the president. I mean, that's the highest law of the land that we have. And so I think until someone comes along and says, you know, we don't have to, you know, adhere to these treaties anymore, then I think we should do what we can as a nation to uphold our end of the bargain to Native people.
So, do tribal members then have full rights of American citizens?
Yes, that's right, and that's where the conundrum comes from, John.
Yeah,
you know, like if we were completely sovereign, then we wouldn't be able to participate in national elections. We would be, you know, confined to just our own tribal elections. But in fact, that's not the case. And in fact, any one of us in Indian country could run for national politics, and we do, and we have, you know, a lot of Native people who have succeeded at the national level, and that's part of the reason why we are U.S. citizens. That's part of the reason why we are, you know, not just distinctly tribal citizens, but we are American citizens.
So you speak of national office, but you're equally eligible for county and state office, is that right?
Oh, yeah. In fact, we have 12 new legislators that were elected here in Montana. Or I take that back. We had, I believe, 5 new elected American Indians just in this past election to add to the 7 who were already on. And so now we have 12 American Indian representatives sitting in the Montana legislature. And I think, from my knowledge, that's an all-time high.
I've been confused for a long time about the status of tribal lands and the issues of jurisdiction within or on reservations or policing rights.
Yeah.
What's the authority of state and federal officials on tribal lands?
Well, it just depends on which reservation. You know, up on the Flathead Reservation, they have a different set of laws compared to the Blackfeet and compared to the Northern Cheyenne and Crow. And I think once you leave the state and you go over into Idaho or into the Dakotas or into Wyoming, it changes again. And so, you know, there's no hard and fast laws about jurisdiction in Indian country. I think, you know, almost every situation is unique. But what we do know is that the federal government has plenary power. They have ultimate authority over Native people. no matter what the instance or no matter what kind of legal case we're talking about.
I just looked at a series that it, on television called Dark Winds. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's set on the Navajo Reservation, and there are tribal police, and they have to deal with the local sheriff, who's a county official, and even FBI authorities. So I'm just wondering if. What's the jurisdiction of tribal police? Do they have any authority beyond tribal borders?
That's a great question. They have very limited authority, in fact. They can only really arrest or give citations to Native people. They don't really have any authority over non-Native people, even on tribal lands. And, of course, their authority ends at the reservation border. So, yeah, I would say that of all of the peacekeepers or peace officers out there, they're the ones with the most limited authority.
And does the local sheriff, does he have standing on within reservation land?
For most reservations, they do. Yes, they do. And in cases of like a hot pursuit or, an immediate danger to the community, county authorities, state authorities, they're all able to operate on the reservation legally with authority.
And when a person such as me, a non-tribal member, goes on to a tribal land, a reservation, are my rights limited in that area?
No, not necessarily. Aspect where that would come up is when you enter onto tribal wilderness areas. And those lands are set aside for only the tribal members of that specific tribe. So even if you didn't belong to that tribe, but you, let's say you were enrolled at Blackfeet and you came to Crow, you are not able to just go up onto the Crow wilderness area without some kind of permission from the tribe. And so that holds true for anyone who's not a member of that tribe, whether you're white, black, or another tribal member from a different reservation.
What kind of authority do tribal governments have on tribal lands? What's the extent of their authority?
That's a great question. I think we're still finding that out. Tribes have yet to really test the full extent of their authority, I think. There are certain instances, and they're tested at certain times on certain instances. For example, cigarette smoking, a Crow agency at the casino, which is now closed, but, the formerly operating casino, cigarettes were allowed, you could smoke in there, but, you couldn't smoke off the reservation in a building. And at the same time, the reservation on the Crow Reservation, alcohol is illegal. It's a dry reservation. And so no one is allowed to have alcohol there, not even non-Indians. And so, but the deal there is that if you're a non-Indian and you get caught with alcohol by the police, they don't have the authority to arrest you or even to take your alcohol. They can only just issue you a warning or, I've never heard of it actually coming to the rubber hitting the road there, but I've never heard of non-Indians, getting in trouble for alcohol on the reservation. In fact, for years there was a fishing lodge over on the Bighorn River that sold whiskey, and everybody knew it, but no one ever challenged them because it was on private property.
So what's the relationship between tribal governments and the counties in which they're located and the states in which they're located? Is there any formal relationship?
That's another great question. I think it varies from county to county, from tribe to tribe. A lot of reservations have two counties, sit within two counties. As far as I know, I don't think there really is any formal set up between tribal administrations and county offices, but I think it's something to consider. I think it would be an important aspect to start to cultivate.
Yeah. And there, how did federal and state highways get built across reservation lands? I guess the feds and states just have superior authority. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yep.
Did the tribes agree to those roads being put in place?
In some instances, they did.
Uh-huh.
In other instances, they didn't. We have more than just, of course, interstates. We have utilities, we have trains, we have all kinds of different things that crisscross our reservation. And technically, for a lot of the treaty tribes that have large land-based reservations, we have the authority to tax those industries. But I don't think, to my knowledge, any of the tribes do at this point.
I'd like to talk about the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs. What's the authority that that agency has?
They have sweeping authority. You know, they were issued the decree to take care of the Indians, watch
uh-huh.
over all of their money, watch over all of their dealings, oversight of everything. And that started back in the 1830s, although the BIA wasn't really established until like the early 20th century. That idea, that concept of the United States as the Great Father overseeing Native people, that's been in the laws since the Supreme Court decision back in the 1830s with the Supreme Court Justice Marshall at the time, the trilogy of cases that established that law.
So, is the Bureau of Indian Affairs regarded today as a positive on the reservations, or is it are there continuing problems?
Well, I think it's probably getting better, but I think there's still continuing problems. And, you know, the Eloise Cabell class action lawsuit that was settled by the Obama administration, I believe back in 2009, was supposed to take care of a lot of these problems, but unfortunately it really hasn't. You know, we still have issues to deal with, and, I'm not sure where we go from here, but... Yeah, I would say the BIA has improved, but it still has a lot of work to do.
What's a typical issue of contention?
Well, for landowners to be able to access information to lands that are being leased, to know all the inside information about those leases, and to be able to access the leasers themselves to speak to them. A lot of people, we don't even know. It's like a total mystery. The BIA takes care of everything. We call people or we send emails, but no one replies. It's still very much an obtuse and opaque institution to try and navigate through as a Native person, the Bureau of Indian Affairs is.
Do they have
very little accountability?
Do they have an office presence on every Indian reservation?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Yep.
And tell me about the Indian Health Service. Is it properly funded? Is it a positive asset on a reservation?
Yeah, that's another problem. The Indian Health Service is not properly funded. You know, it needs more money to function adequately as it's meant to perform. I think that there's a lot of shortcomings with the Indian Health Service, and I think if you drive around rural Montana or visit some of the hospitals in rural Montana, you'll see some of the challenges that they face. And, you know, I don't want to just say that it's just them. Of course, rural Montana struggles with a lot of other services,
mm-hmm.
Both on and off reservations. But I think for sure, Indian Health Service has a high ceiling that they can, they have a long ways to go to improve their services.
Let me move on and ask you about gambling casinos. They can be built on land that is acquired by the tribe outside of the designated reservation land. So does that site then, after it's acquired, does that become reservation land by acquisition?
Not to my knowledge, no. No, you can't assume some private land ownership as a reservation now. I think that that would take an act of Congress. You know, I'm not sure about all of the different qualifications. One thing I know is that any tribe here in Montana who wanted to build a casino off the reservation would have to first get it approved by the state of Montana. And I don't think that the state of Montana, considering that we're in a deep red state right now, that doesn't necessarily support, you know, gambling or, you know, tribal, quote, sovereignty, we're going to see much movement in that area.
Do tribal police have authority in a gambling casino that's off reservation land?
No.
They do not?
No.
Wow. Okay. Let's see. Okay, the Keystone Pipeline. Let's talk about that. Eventually, it was built across reservation lands, right?
Yes, it was. Yep.
And what was the outcome of that? There was a huge protest over in North Dakota, and what was the resolution of that?
Well, I think the Trump administration decided that they were going to support the continued building of the pipeline, and so it went ahead and was built. I think the Obama administration put a pause on it at the time, but since then the pipeline's been built
Wasn't the pipeline supposed to go through a waterway, and that was the principal concern, that it would break or leak and contaminate the waterway? And was it eventually built that way, or was it circumvented? Did the pipeline circumvent that waterway, whatever it was?
I think that was one of the concerns. Another of the concerns was that it went through a sacred site, a burial site. And that the Native American Grave Protection Repatriation Act protected that ground from that kind of industry. So there were a couple of big issues that the tribes wanted resolved, and that they didn't want that pipeline being built. But I think, again, at the end of the day, they lost their case.
Mm. Too bad. Well, Shane, I think we've run our course, so it has been a great conversation. I really enjoyed talking with you. It's been a long time, and it's good to be connecting again. So thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Our guest today has been Dr. Shane Doyle, a Bozeman, Montana-based scholar, teacher, and community advocate. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to jswilderness.com or to kgvm.org and see additional features of our website and listen to additional broadcasts. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Shell.